The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, after 40 years in this business, this is my 10th presidential election as an investment advisor. It's very easy to find people that will talk about the political side of elections, but very difficult to find someone who can talk about the economic side of an election. And we were very fortunate because Dr. Jerry Webman of Oppenheimer Funds, chief economist of Oppenheimer Funds, has done us a big favor. He has authored a piece called Everything Investors Need to Know and Should Ignore About the Upcoming Election. So I'm very excited to have him on the show today, and I appreciate him being with us. Dr. Webman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good morning, Michael. I'm very glad to be with you.
Yeah, this is a great piece, and I really like, you know, Everything Investors Should Know. You see a lot of things that that start out with start the title out that way, but I love the part where and should ignore about the elections. What are some of the things that we, first of all, I guess, should pay attention to about these upcoming elections?
Well, you know, obviously this matters for a whole lot of aspects of our lives, our values, our beliefs, and so forth. But when it comes to whether it should change our investment portfolios or not, I think the first thing we should do is make sure we've got a good financial plan in place and not let this disturb it. So down the road, when we get the platforms a little clearer, when we kind of know what the, how the campaign is going, although we should come back to how we could be misled by that, maybe we begin to think about fine tuning. But my overall point is, there's nothing in the election that ought to get you off the financial plan you've probably already put in place or should be in the process of putting in place.
Absolutely. And then what should we, just over in a broad view before we get into the details, what are some of the things that we should ignore that typically come up? Because, you know, obviously the voting public and the investing public is bombarded by all kinds of statements from both sides of the aisle, and you know, some of them are quite frightening, you know, of all the things that could happen if you elect the other person. Obviously we should probably ignore all of that, correct?
Well, let's start with one thing that, you know, I think whatever you're, whether you wear a blue suit or a red suit, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you probably would consider that the Republicans are the more business-friendly of the two political parties. You'd probably think, therefore, if we have a Republican in the White House, on them, all else equal, you'd expect the stock market to do a little better if we have Republicans in charge. Turns out, if we go back 90 years when we have good data, we can track this, it actually makes very little difference. In fact, the stock market on average has done a little better when Democrats control the White House. Now, that's not advice to change your portfolio one way or the other, because the differences, I think, are you know, so small it doesn't matter. But just to kind of think about the things we should ignore, saying, oh my goodness, you know, if the wrong party's in charge, the disaster is going to happen. As far as the stock market's concerned, that just hasn't been the case.
Now, I've heard that before, and I'm going to show my complete consumer ignorance here. The reason for that happening, and that things tend to be better and the markets tend to be better when Democrats are in, I've been told in the past, is because they're more for government stimulus, and they get the government more involved in the financial process. You've got the government expanding and spending more money, putting more people to work. Is that true or not?
You know, I don't think I would take it even to that level. In fact, if I take out a few extreme cases, for example, remember this is over almost a century. If we take out the Hoover administration, you know, from 1928 to 1933, or 1929 to 1933, it's almost exactly equal. So it's a couple of extreme cases. I think what really matters here is, if I had to leave you with one statistic, I often like to ask people, it'll be this one, I often like to ask people what they think the percent of the U.S. economy, so our gross domestic product, all the goods and services we produce, all our spending, if I ask people how much of that is explained by government spending at all levels, from, you know, the federal government right down to the library, the public library, what percent is that of the U.S. economy? People say, oh, must be 30%, 35%. Of course, it's 18%. So the truth is most of 80% of what happens in the U.S. economy happens because of what folks like you and I, and I've got to guess most of the folks listening to this show do in their own private businesses. So we explain a lot by the government. It's very important. I don't want to say it doesn't matter at all, but it's not what dominates the economy.
Now, it seems like recently, the last several years, or not just this current administration, but for quite a while now, there seems to be increasing government regulation, more and more regulations. You know, the industry that we're in,
yep.
They've really ramped that up lately. Doesn't that in the long run impact our GDP and impact how well our economy and our investment world works? And could a philosophy that's in office have an influence on that?
You know, it's a great question. I mean, particularly in our industry, these things tend to go in cycles. So after the Great Depression in the 1930s, we got a big spate of financial regulation that kind of tied the hands of people who are asset managers like ourselves or financial advisors like yourself. And after the financial crisis and Great Recession of last decade, we did the same thing. So we've certainly tightened up regulations on us. And, you know, I guess you and I both think we don't need to be regulated. We're going to do business our honest way, regardless. But it does slow down certain kinds of activity. It probably has meant that the financial sector, the big financial institutions, particularly the big banks, are less profitable, are probably doing less business because there's more regulation. Now, you know, if I'm trying to be nonpartisan here, I debate about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing with some of the business that many financial institutions were doing 10, 12 years ago probably damaged the economy more than helped it. But it comes down to it. We'd rather see markets in charge than regulators trying to think what's best for us. But we probably needed a little more regulation a decade ago than we had, or a little more sensible regulation, if there is such a thing. And it probably slows things down a little bit, but sometimes it is wise to slow down, take a breath, and ask ourselves what we really should be doing.
And I don't know if this is too political, so if it's too hot a question, you can certainly back off with this one. But did Wall Street cause some of its own problems? I mean, the regulation that we've had over the last several years, obviously some of that I think has emanated from what happened in 2007, 8, and 9. Did Wall Street really create some of its own issues that needed to be regulated?
I think we got – I don't know if I have to say we needed to be regulated, but I do think we got – a little bit too enthusiastic about things like what was in the near term profitable for some of the big institutions, and secondly, what our brilliant mathematical models told us. I think we got so excited about thinking that we could use math and statistics and clever derivatives to lay off all the risk that we'd taken risk out of the markets, and we actually created a lot more risk. So whether that we shouldn't be surprised in a democracy like ours or a republic like ours is going to call down more regulation on us when it comes to grief. It did come to grief. We shouldn't be surprised we brought that regulation down on ourselves. We did get a little too exuberant about how clever we could be.
Yeah, I think you're right. I totally agree with you. I think we did kind of bring some of this on ourselves. I tell you what, I'd like to hold you over for the next session because you came up with in your latest piece one caveat and two predictions. Frankly, I was a little surprised that you stepped out there and made predictions. I'm very impressed. And if you don't mind hanging on, we'll come back and share those with the audience. So, folks,
absolutely.
We've got Dr. Jerry Webman today. He's chief economist for Oppenheimer Funds. We're talking politics and the impact of elections. Stay with us. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. Back in a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
For those of you that are just joining us, we have Dr. Jerry Webman with us today. Dr. Webman is chief economist for the Oppenheimer Funds and has written a wonderful piece that we're going to release to our clients. If you're on our email list, Please make sure you get on there, because I'll make sure you get a copy of this. It's everything investors need to know and should ignore about the upcoming election. And I can tell you, folks, having read it twice, it's a great piece. And Dr. Webman, you have one caveat and two predictions. So I'm going to kind of turn the floor over to you and let you talk about those to the listeners.
Well, thanks. Well, the caveat we talked about a little bit already. It is, I'll tell you how and why we can make today's best guess about the outcome of the November election, tell you how to get there and how you can keep track of it yourself. The caveat is, you know, do it as a citizen, do it as you pay attention to lots of issues, but don't let it overly influence the way you think about your investment plans for this year, next year, and the next decade. So that's the caveat. The predictions are, let me step back a second. When I was teaching political science back 35 years ago, public opinion polls were just the gold standard. If they were doing a great job of telling us how voters were likely to behave when an election came along, how they were likely to vote, who the likely winners would be. Because of the way in which some of our behaviors changed, in particular the fact that many people, let's say nobody under the age of 40 has got a landline anymore. We all use cell phones, and you can't reach people on a cell phone, and we don't talk to people on public opinion polls. The polls have become very inaccurate. You probably noticed that during the primary season, or you noticed it with some of the U.S. and foreign elections over the last few years. But there's another way to look at the likely outcome of elections, and in fact a whole lot of other events as well. And that's something that dwells on markets and the so-called wisdom of crowds. Turns out, as some of you may know, you can actually go online and make bets on the outcome of lots of elections. Now, by the way, it's illegal to run one of these betting sites in the U.S. They tend to be based in Ireland, New Zealand, the Channel Islands, Britain, and so forth. And those betting websites have been better predictors of the outcome through this primary season. So I like to look at them. They've been very good at placing odds on outcomes. So that's going to let me, having looked at a series of these betting websites, there's one called PredictWise that brings a bunch of them together. PredictIt.com is another one people look at. You can Google it and you'll find lots of them. So I'll tell you what they predict right now. What they predict right now is continuing gridlock in Washington after we get past the next election. In particular, the odds are very strong. As we sit right now, events will change. As we sit right now, the odds are almost three-quarters that the Democratic presidential candidate, probably Secretary Clinton, wins the presidential election. They're almost a toss-up with a slight edge to the Democrats for getting a small majority in the Senate, and they are overwhelmingly pointing to Republicans continuing to control the House of Representatives. So that means we probably face gridlock in the next, in 2017, 18, probably until 2020, of the similar way we've seen in the past. So that's my prediction. We should come back and talk about what that means about major policy issues. But it does mean that there's not likely to be one party firmly in control of what the government does. It also says we should expect some amount of continuity between what we've seen over the last 8 years and what we're likely to see over the next 4 years.
Let me
pause there, Mike, and see what you want to pick up among those ideas.
Yeah, no. And so, folks, to kind of break that down for you using headlines from Dr. Webman's report, the caveat is that forecasting is not an exact science. There's some interesting places we can go now to kind of look where the odds are. The prediction one is that the Republican Party can likely retain control of the House of Representatives, and it's a real toss-up, but there's a good shot for the Democrats to take over the Senate once again. So that puts us in somewhat of a gridlock. Gridlock typically in Washington doesn't bode very well, Dr. Webman, because we've had gridlock for quite a while. And I think you mentioned in your report, in fact, it's really interesting, you mentioned in report that people have actually been angrier about Congress in the past. You compared them to lice, I think, at one time. Congress was down there I don't remember it, lice and something else that they were
some diseases that we probably don't want to mention on family radio, I think, Mike, is what we're what we're talking about. We have a pretty someone who's been following this over the years has and you're using surveys here, has told us that mostly our affection for our own parties probably weakened over the last decades a little bit, but our dislike, you could even say hatred, of the opposition party has really intensified. So we really tend to react very emotionally. So I gave you something for Democrats to like and something for Republicans to like, and what I told you before. But I'm going to guess that that many of us reacted to that by not feeling good that our party was going to get control of at least one section of government, but to get really angry that the other party was going to control some other part of it. We need to keep that emotion in check when it comes to thinking about our investment, because we probably, if we're like the typical American, we feel those emotions more intently than we ever have before.
Absolutely. You made an interesting point in your piece about how the president doesn't necessarily have to be popular to be effective.
Isn't that interesting?
It is.
Let's not talk. We didn't say effective. We said for the stock market to make money for people. You know, it's kind of interesting. We sort of sit here and say, you know, if we didn't have this, you know, gloomy view about what was going on in Washington, if we thought they were doing a better job, we'd be more confident the stock market would do better. So we went and looked at stock market performance in different patterns of presidential popularity. So you'd think, well, if the president's pretty popular, that must mean things are going pretty well, and that must be when the stock market does well. It turns out, this is why you got to go and do the research, it turns out that the best returns on the stock market actually occur when the president is mildly unpopular, when the president's approval ratings are between 35 and 50%. So less than half of us, fewer than half of us, support the president, but he's not dreadfully unpopular, but unpopular. Actually, those are correlated with the best returns in the stock market. And we did this study over the last 60 years or so. So,
wow.
You know, there's a lot of things that we just assume from one part of our I guess my point really is to come back to the same one. We got to keep our emotions in check when it comes to thinking about how markets are really going to behave and how they can do their work for us.
Speaking of markets, I've got to switch very quickly because we only have a short time left. What are your thoughts about the markets going forward? Are we a lot of people have said we're into a very flat, lackluster year. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think in terms of the U.S. market, we probably have some modest upside from here, but it's not a really cheap market. Earnings are a little bit challenged. We're starting to see people get paid a little better, which in the long run is a good thing. In the short run, some companies are not going to be as profitable. So I think the stock market will be higher by the beginning of next year than it is now, but not by a lot.
All right.
So,
Dr. Webman, do you have a few more minutes to stay with us?
Sure, I do.
Well, if you could, I'd like to ask you about energy. So if you'll just stay with us, folks, we'll be back in just a few moments. We've got Dr. Jerry Webman with us, Chief Economist, Oppenheimer Funds. Back in a moment. You're listening to Straight Talk Money.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
This guest this morning has been so interesting that he's been kind enough at least to stay with us for just a few minutes longer. We've had with us today Dr. Jerry Webman, a chief economist with the Oppenheimer Funds. We've been talking politics this morning, but we're going to veer off of that a little bit because he was just as we were going out, we were talking about the markets being fairly lackluster, that not to expect a whole lot. And a lot of folks say, Dr. Webman, that this could extend over a period of years, that even the next president probably won't have a chance to really jumpstart the economy, and it may be a while before the demographics of changing of generation picks up. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's a really important question. Where I differ a little bit is I don't think the president picks up the economy. I think, you know, we the people pick up the economy. This demographic point that you made, Mike, let's dwell on that for a moment because I don't think it gets enough attention. You know, there are more millennials than there are baby boomers. that right. our biggest age cohorts are 20 and early 30-somethings. Now, just like, you know, when you and I, going back a few decades, were that age, you know, we don't kind of get our careers going for a while, but once we do, we create a lot of impact. So birth rates are up, family formation is up, housing demand is up. I think for the next 5 to 10 years, this could be very positive for the U.S. economy. And it's something people aren't recognizing. Housing market, I think, stays strong for a while. I think business creation probably starts to pick up, even though it's lagged a little bit. So, you know, the next president will probably claim credit for all this stuff, this good stuff happening, if it does happen. But I think it's actually simply this glacial effect of a lot of young people moving into that 30, 35, 40-year-old working, saving, investing, and prospering part of their life cycle. And, of course, whoever's president will claim credit for it, but it's really about we the people and not about about what the politicians do.
Absolutely. In fact, you mentioned during the break that, you know, we really shouldn't change our investment philosophy and our investments per se just because of this election, correct?
Yeah, I mean, tactically, if one president or the other, one person, party or the other wins, you know, some industries will do a little better.
Right.
You'd expect, you know, defense to do a little better under a Republican administration, or maybe the infrastructure businesses do a little better when the Democrats are in charge, if they're able to get their agenda passed through Congress. But in terms of do I own stock, bonds, cash, what my long-term asset allocation, that's something I'm talking to my financial advisor about and staying with my plan.
Okay. As you know, we broadcast live here through both Texas and Colorado, both states that have been very, very heavily affected by the changes in energy. Energy recently has bumped back up above 50. It's under some pressure today because of the strengthening of the dollar. But do you have any thoughts about where we're headed in energy? Are we moving higher? Is the worst past us? Any thoughts about that?
I believe we're getting into a range. I mean, excuse me, you know, we forget that the U.S. between 2008-2015 went from producing 25% of our crude domestically to producing almost 50% of it domestically. That was going to affect world markets. It depressed them for a while. We've cut back on new exploration. The rig count, as I'm sure people in your listening area are very well aware, fell substantially. It looks as though it's bottom. And in fact, recently, just very slightly, I think the number was 9, we started last week or two getting additional rigs, drilling rigs, brought into operation. So that tells me that at this level, the people who produce petroleum, produce oil, are starting to say, hey, we can drill and produce and pump at this level again. That tells me we've kind of found a range that the market likes for the price of crude. So I would, obviously we're going to have some volatility, and certainly day by day, week by week, but I think we're probably 45 to 55 is probably a range that it's reasonable to expect until something else shocks the market. But I think knowing what we know now, we're probably in the midst of a range.
Because we're able to bring on more crude quickly now with better technology, do you think that the top end of the range has been truncated? In other words, we're not likely to see 100 plus oil in the future?
That would be my opinion. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I haven't been in Eagle Ford, but I've been up in Bakken a few times over the last few years. And it is true that, you know, this is not deep water drilling where it takes a long time to pump that first barrel. You know, if you're drilling in a sugar beet field in western North Dakota, you can start pumping pretty quickly. So, yeah, and there are a lot of wells that are drilled but not completed, which means production can come on quickly in response to oil that gets higher than where we are now. So, again, I'm hesitant to talk about it because I'm going to guess you have listeners who are real experts in this industry. But as someone standing back looking at the big picture, I think you're right that we've probably capped the price. You know, barring something in say the Middle East that disrupts global supply, but I think we've capped that price.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit about the Federal Reserve. Peggy would like to know
Yes, I'd like to get your thoughts on the Federal Reserve. I mean, it seems like every day they're going, are they going to pull the trigger or are they not going to pull the trigger? Right. When they finally do, is it going to make that big of an impact on how our lives are being led now?
Well, you know, they do something to control interest rates called open market operations. They also do something, and that's what you're referring to, called open mouth operations, where they're trying to help us understand what they're doing. And in the process of trying to help us understand, I think sometimes confuse us. For example, they raised interest rates by 0.25% last December. You know, economically, that shouldn't have made a big difference. But a few senior people with the Fed were saying, yeah, and we're going to do this several more times during 2016. That got the stock market pretty much upset because the stock market sensed in its collective wisdom that we couldn't stand all those rate hikes during 2016. Lo and behold, we haven't gotten them. So the Fed's going to meet this coming week. They will not do anything this week. They're going to meet again in July, maybe 25% probability. They raise interest rates by 25 basis points then, and probably a 50 to 60% probability at least once by the end of the year. And they will try to communicate with us about what they're expecting to do. Here's what we need to know. The Fed is going to be very reluctant to do anything in monetary policy that would disrupt this grindingly slow growth economy. So they are going to say a lot of things, and people like me are going to say a lot about what they say a lot about, but recognize that the Fed wants to raise interest rates, but they will do it even more gradually than they have thought they're going to do it. So I wouldn't be worried too much about the Fed. I wish we could stop paying attention to them altogether.
I think they probably wish the very same thing.
Exactly right.
Interestingly enough, although we had an increase in December, the 10-year today is actually lower than it was when they increased in December. Is it possible that they raise rates a couple times and really have very little impact on the bond portfolios that investors may have?
Well, by the way, raising them sometimes can lower the long-term interest rates because it makes us say, well, growth and inflation are probably going to be slower in the future because the Fed's raising short-term rates. So you get this phenomenon which you described, which we call flattening of the yield curve. In other words, less right. difference between very short-term interest rates and longer-term interest rates. And that's actually something you want to pay close attention to.
Yes, you do. Dr. Webman, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great show. Thank you for staying over this third segment. And we look forward to further comments that you'll have about the elections.
Well,
thank you,
I
sir. Have a great weekend.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.